I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. First Bradley Manning, then Edward Snowden. Now a new name is surfacing in connection with leaks of secret material.
And it is a man who was the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We're learning more today about news that retired General James Cartwright is being investigated for allegedly leaking classified information about a covert U.S.-Israeli cyber attack on Iran's nuclear program. Greg Miller covers national security for The Washington Post. And Greg, first off, tell us more about General James Cartwright.
Cartwright is a retired four-star Marine Corps general who's had a series of high-level positions in the military. He was the number two military officer in the country before he retired, and he was part of Obama's inner circle throughout Obama's first term. He was involved in a lot of critical decisions on counterterrorism stuff and on conflicts with other adversaries, including Iran, which is what he's in the news about again today.
Yeah, it's amazing that he was in Obama's inner circle, and now the administration is telling you that he is suspected of revealing information about this effort to cyber attack Iran's nuclear program. Tell us about that.
In his background, he had been the head of Cyber Command, so he had been in charge of, you know, the military's apparatus that deals with cyber threats and also has some offensive capability. And this story, which surfaced last year first in the New York Times, was the first big-time source story about a cyber attack that the United States had launched against an enemy, in this case, Iran. And it used a worm or piece of malware called Stuxnet that was designed to cripple centrifuges. It was designed to get into the computer networks that are connected to Iran's nuclear program and cause equipment to break down. And it appears to have worked.
It worked, so it did have an effect.
Yeah, I mean, they lost 1,000 or so centrifuges. I mean, it was a setback. It wasn't like it stopped their program in its tracks, but it was a considerable setback, and, you know, it was a big deal.
Well, so why would, if these accusations are true, why would somebody who was so close to the president, so high up in the military, leak information like this?
Well, obviously, we have to say we don't know that he did.
Right.
I mean, he hasn't been charged. He hasn't been indicted. He has been notified that he is a target now of this investigation, which is, you know, stops well short of those distinctions. But this is how Washington has worked for years. Generally, I mean, without saying what General Cartwright did or didn't in this case, senior U.S. officials who leave government for a number of reasons often talk about the programs that they were involved in. Where they have to be careful and where they have the potential to get into trouble is where those programs were as secret and as sensitive as a cyber campaign against Iran.
And put this in the context of what is going on right now. I mean, we've got just leak after leak after leak and prosecution after prosecution of these leaks. There's Bradley Manning, the Army private who's accused of leaking hundreds of thousands of classified documents. Of course, Edward Snowden, this former NSA contractor who has admitted that he gave classified documents to The Guardian and The Washington Post. And now this guy, General Cartwright, who at a time not too long ago was one of the highest ranking military officials in the country, if it's true, of course.
Right. And of course, so the Obama administration has taken a lot of heat for launching investigations and prosecutions into leaks cases. It's done this, you know, there have been at least eight cases so far, not counting Cartwright, which is far more than all other administrations throughout history combined. So, I mean, this administration has a reputation for being extremely aggressive about this stuff. But this is the first real case where it now looks like it has turned on and set its sights on one of its own. I mean, somebody who was, by all accounts, a very close advisor to the president himself.
Does it seem that the leak prosecutions are deterring other potential leakers?
Well, I mean, it certainly didn't deter Snowden, did it? I mean, there his leaks came at a point where there had been lots of public hand-wringing about the investigations into these cases, but he took things in a very different direction. Obviously, he seems to have made a very conscious decision that he was going to expose some activities by the NSA, and then he was going to own up to it, at least to the extent that he was going to identify himself as the source and not try to remain hidden.
Greg Miller covers national security for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As as many know, George Zimmerman is on trial in Florida, charged with murder in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, but also being judged the language being used by one witness. In fact, language has been quite in the spotlight this week. Here's Chef Paula Deen being asked on the Today Show about her acknowledgement that she used the N-word.
I don't know, Matt. I have asked myself that so many times because it's very distressing for me to go into my kitchens and I hear what these young people are calling each other.
So Paula Deen saying she's not sure if it's offensive, and as if on cue, one young person did use the N-word, Rachel Jean Tell, who was on the phone with her childhood friend Trayvon Martin when he and George Zimmerman got into that altercation. She said he used the N-word in quoting what Trayvon told her when he thought a man was following him.
And then he said, still following me now. That is still following me now.
That he's still following him?
Yes.
Lawyers then asked her what else Trayvon said.
I asked him how the man looked like. He looked like a creepy cracker.
Okay. Then what happened?
And then he said, still following me.
And the defense team often said they couldn't understand her.
I had told you. You listening?
But last night on MSNBC, linguist John Wartner had this response.
She said in the clip that I had told you, and many people are thinking, why is she using the pluperfect? That's Black English. My cousins did that when I was little. It's the narrative pluperfect. Linguists talk about it. There's a dissertation about it.
Well, let's start there with John Rickford, professor of linguistics and humanities at Stanford University. Professor Rickford, so is linguist John McWhorter right? Is this a dialect?
Oh, yes. Yeah. John McWhorter, who is my student here at Stanford University, is perfectly right. And linguists who have been studying African-American vernacular English or Ebonics since the early 1960s recognize all the features in Rachel Gentile's speech. One that seemed to throw the court for a loop was the point at which she was asked whether she was, you know, now beginning to pay attention. And she said, I've been paying attention, sir, meaning I've been paying attention for a long time and I'm still paying attention. I'm not sure they ever really got that right. So she used a lot of the classic features of African-American English, which you can find spoken, especially by working-class African-Americans, almost every day. I don't think most of these cause actual problems of understanding in the courtroom, but I think they probably affected the jury's and certainly the public's ability to respect and believe her testimony and to relate to her. Relatability is very important.
Relatability. Well, actually, you did tell me that you thought it might have affected her testimony because there was one point where there was a misunderstanding about what she
said. Yeah, very, very crucial point. And one of the things that I think worried me a lot is the fact that the prosecution didn't make more of an effort to benefit from an interpreter. Now, of course, people might consider it, you know, ridiculous in some ways to have an interpreter for a person who spoke a deep dialect of American English. But there was a crucial point on the tape from the interview she had in April 2012 with Bernie de la Rionda, in which she said she heard someone saying, get off. And he said, but could you tell who was saying that? And the transcript reads, I couldn't know Trayvon or I couldn't hear Trayvon, none of which makes any semantic sense in context. But when you listen to it, those of us who were linguists who were listening to it, we heard it pretty clearly as I could, and it was Trayvon.
Well, Professor, I just want to pick up on what you've said, though, because you are saying that this is an African-American dialect, but there are many African-Americans who have said, I don't speak that way. I know, you know, anecdotally, an African-American mother who insists that her child not speak that way because she doesn't accept that there should be a different dialect for African-Americans. What do you say to people who say this reflects something else, a lack of willingness to speak the mainstream English, or that there shouldn't be different dialects for different people and interpreters for them at trials?
Yeah, but, you know, language can't really be legislated. Many of the same people who will make those critiques of what their children might speak. You see, African-American vernacular English is like a testament to the existence of difference. And many African-Americans themselves who are speakers of these varieties will say that to their kids and then use many of the features themselves. I mean, at the height of the Ebonics controversy, I remember one person saying, you know, ain't nobody here speaking no Ebonics. So you have to be careful to distinguish between features of the vernacular that are used just by younger people, more slang, like a lot of the use of the N-word in reference to friends and so on, is more characteristic of people beneath a certain age, and a lot of older people critique it. And then there are lots of other features of African-American English, like the use of the word kitchen for the hair at the back of the neck, you know, which tends to be more curly and kinky and so on and so
forth. What's the word?
And, you know, if somebody talks about their kitchen, they got to go to the hairdresser to try and get their kitchen looked after. Then they're talking about the hair at the back of the neck. And a lot of these features, you know, when she says things like, he a mama boy, he trying to get home, these are all excerpts from her testimony, or he love his family. All those grammatical features, the absence of the possessive, the absence of auxiliary is, and he trying to get home, those are widespread throughout the African-American community.
By the way, is this a racial divide in language, or is it a cultural divide? In other words, are there pockets of America where lower-income whites have a different dialect?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Because people seem to agree that language is this, you know, profound mark of education and worth, then you can often beat up on it when you want to beat up on other aspects of people without fear of being criticized. Mm-hmm. So there are many things that Rachel Jean Tell represents, but she is herself a victim. This is her childhood friend. She knew him from kindergarten, and she's talking about what she heard. And instead, she's the one that's being put on trial, not only by the defense attorneys, but by all of America.
Professor, after the break, we're going to take up the use of the N-word. But I know you wanted to comment on the use of the word cracker.
Well, a couple things about the use of the word cracker. First of all, it's Dictionary of American Regional English shows very clearly that it's regionally restricted. So, you know, you hear it in Florida and in some surrounding southern states, South Carolina, Georgia, pretty much unknown among the general population in, you know, New York and many other parts of the country. I think there are two points to be made about creepy-ass cracker. The defense tried to suggest that she may have lied because in her earlier interview in 2012 with attorney Bernie de la Rionda, she hadn't actually used that word, which is true. She hadn't used that expression, but she did report that Trayvon said that the guy who was following her was white, and he said that the guy looked creepy. So it's not a big semantic leap from creepy white guy to creepy ass cracker. And it's particularly so because there's a whole grammar of ass words in African-American English showing that it's a part of, you know, uncensored speech, particularly among younger African-Americans. The words are not inherently negative or positive.
It sounds as if, as a linguist, you would strip away some of the words around that, and it's the word creepy that you might hear.
Oh, yes. As she said, for her, in this case, it meant pervert. Something that the guy is doing that causes some alarm.
That's John Rickford, professor of linguistics and humanities at Stanford University. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're talking about the national conversation that's been launched by a young Haitian-American woman named Rachel Jean Tell, who's testifying for the prosecution in the trial of George Zimmerman, who's accused of killing her childhood friend Trayvon Martin. Defense attorneys have often said they couldn't understand her, and much has been made of her using the N-word and the word cracker to quote Trayvon. Linguist John Rickford just told us that in Jean Tell's dialect, she's actually being grammatically accurate. And even her use of the word cracker in that dialect follows clear linguistic rules. But what about the cultural questions, especially since Paula Deen admitted using the N-word and said she was confused because she heard blacks using it? Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad is with us. He's the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. And Dr. Muhammad, first of all, what are you hearing specifically in this trial?
I am hearing the testimony of a 19-year-old, a teenager, someone who's finishing high school, talking about the tragedy of having lost a friend and being one of the few people who can testify to what Trayvon was experiencing at the moment that he was encountered by George Zimmerman. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, what do you make of the furor in social media? There are people
who are obviously racist. That's happening. There are people who are also curious. You know, what are we hearing? They don't understand what they're hearing. And then I'm reading on some black blogs. Here's News One. There seems to be a divide within the black community. I'm reading a blogger who's saying there are the talented 10th black people who are voicing their disgust at this young woman's inability to code switch, to change her language for the trial. They're ridiculing her skin color, her weight, and her speech, even though Creole and Spanish are her first language. So there seem to be all sorts of corners from which this is being viewed.
Yeah, it's a very tricky landscape, although it's always been tricky. And in some ways, these various responses from the racist to the confused to those articulating long-standing classist notions of a proper black person or proper black behavior are enduring problems in American culture. Problems only from the standpoint in that they get in the way of recognizing people's humanity. In other words, what's on trial here is the measure of justice, not the measure of her speech, and the notion that somehow she is articulating what happened in such a way that is surprising to people is no different than the trouble I have, Robin, with a strong Boston accent when I encounter it. Sometimes it's very difficult to navigate the regional accents and the dialects that exist in our culture, and it just seems that in this case, given this particular moment in trial, it's been blown out of proportion, that particular issue.
Well, and to talk more about within the black community, because I'm seeing a comment here from someone saying, it's tragic how quickly and with so much glee some black people are throwing our black youth under the bus. People are now ashamed of her. You've said that she's probably conscious that other blacks are viewing her in a certain way, and that's maybe adding to what we sometimes see as discomfort.
Yes, this is a kind of an everyday problem for some African Americans in their homes, in their communities. Oftentimes it comes up in the case of a local crime scene. Someone on the street is interviewed, and it happens to be a person whose formal education is at such a level that they don't speak what we might all call proper English. And I know John just talked about this, and I'm not weighing in on the debate, the normative value of whether that's good or bad, only to say that this observation of either ebonics or black language or inappropriate use of grammar in speaking causes a lot of shame within many African-American households when they watch this. And it's true even to black immigrant households where the need to show one's respectability is very intense. And so this assimilating into mainstream culture for black immigrants, be they Caribbean or African, is also predicated on this notion of how correctly you speak English. Mm-hmm. So that this problem is a kind of an everyday occurrence. The difference here is that it has reached the national stage, given the Zimmerman trial and what it has meant for a generation of young people, be they millennials or Generation Y. This is their moment for being represented in an important national moment. And many people are criticizing this young woman because she's not living up to what should be a proper racial representation.
Well, and John McWhorter, the other linguist that we spoke of from Columbia, said that there's a lot of hypocrisy, too, because everybody has heard this language from formerly poor, now very wealthy hip-hop artists who are using it quite a bit, and it's being enjoyed by maybe some of the same people who are criticizing it now in this young woman. But I just want to get in. You compare this trial to the trial of the Scottsboro Boys. These were the 9 black teens accused of rape in Alabama in 1931 and found guilty. What's the connection?
Well, the connection is that for a group of young men ranging in age from 13 to 19, their class position, being the children of sharecroppers in Alabama in the 1930s, positioned them as being unworthy of representing the larger racial and class struggles of that period. And so the justice that was on trial, being falsely accused of raping 2 white women, was not sufficient for the standard bearer of the black middle class community, the NAACP at that time, to represent them for fear that essentially their own questionable class position was not a good representation of the race. And so they wait for another case. This also happened in the case of Claudette Colvin, who several months before Rosa Parks was in a position to be a lead plaintiff in the case to strike down segregation in Montgomery. Yeah. And there again, the NAACP thought after she was arrested, she subsequently ended up pregnant by the time of the trial. She was not a good poster representation of the race.
And Khalil Muhammad, I just want to get in. Obviously, there was also discussion of the N-word. Randall Kennedy wrote the terrific book on the N-word years ago, but does it boil down to, very, very briefly, does it just boil down to how you use it? I mean, if it's as a slur or as a casual word?
It matters in the same way that individuals inside their own homes get to call people what they want to call them. When you step out into the public, you don't get to say what you want to say.
Yeah.
And so in this case, that's what got Paula Deen in trouble.
Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. Thanks so much for weighing in.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take a break. Latest news is next. Here and now.
Like a lot of summer weekends, this weekend brings a new buddy cop movie, but this one, called The Heat, is a little different.
I'm Special Agent Sarah Ashburn. Are you about to be interrogated by an officer?
I am an officer, and that's my perk.
Could you just close the door on the way out?
I'll shut the door on you.
The buddy cops in The Heat are played by Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock. Joining us to talk about this twist on a familiar genre is Linda Holmes, who writes and edits NPR's Monkey See blog. Linda, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Well, so this is a very familiar genre of movie with a very long history. We've all seen these buddy cop movies before.
That's right. You've got your Lethal Weapon, your 48 Hours, more recently stuff like 21 Jump Street, and it's got a long history, not just in movies, but of course on television,
right.
Something like, and sometimes in both. Starsky and Hutch is in both. It was a TV series in the 70s, and then in 2004, they made a movie with Owen Wilson and Ben Stiller.
You haven't filed a report, turned in any money, or you haven't even arrested anybody.
How can I arrest them? They'll know I'm a cop.
Oh, I wouldn't worry. I don't think you're in any danger of being mistaken for a real cop.
Oh, really? Hey, why don't you do me a favor and go get yourself another perm and let the grown-ups talk?
Now, of course, The Heat is different in many ways, not least because it stars the amazing and hilarious Melissa McCarthy. What's different about The Heat than these other buddy cop movies?
Given the fact that the cops are women, what makes it interesting is partly how much it is a formula buddy cop movie in a pretty pure way. It's all about the relationship between the straight arrow cop, that's the FBI agent that Sandra Bullock is playing, and the doesn't play by the rules cop, that's the detective that from Boston that Melissa McCarthy is playing. And, of course, there's an underlying plot involving crime and drugs that's not terribly involving, which is pretty much the rule for this kind of movie. You get bored when they're actually dealing with the criminals and you want them to just go back to making lots and lots of jokes. So it is following that formula, except that it's extremely rare for the cops to be women.
Well, is this something that is going to change the genre, do you think?
Well, normally when you get a movie that has women who are friends, you wind up with a very limited palette. You wind up with them giving each other makeovers and somebody has to get a boyfriend. And this really is a cop movie. It's banter. It's fighting. It's guns and knives and a lot of swearing, I should say. But the fact that they don't try to make it a girl cop movie is sort of what's most revolutionary about it, I think.
Well, and then the other thing that's revolutionary, of course, is that there are, as we've said, two women in a buddy cop movie. And this summer has not been a big one for movies that star women.
No, I actually looked at the inspired by a row of movie posters for this summer's movies with a lot of guys in T-shirts. I actually went around and counted the screenings in my area a couple of weeks ago and found that at the multiplexes, there were no movies with female leads at all. Zero. There were a few in art houses, but there were zero in multiplexes. That won't be true all summer. There will be this one. The Bling Ring is open now. But a lot of the time, there are none. So this particular season, just for having women in it, it is unusual.
What's that about? Did you find out?
I don't know that there's anything to it other than the fact that people conclude that movies with women don't make as much money, so they don't make them, and then they don't make money, and then people stop making them, and it's sort of cyclical, I think, in that way.
And, of course, Melissa McCarthy is well known for her performance in another film that starred women and was sort of groundbreaking in that sense. Also, by the way, directed by the same person who is directing The Heat, and that would be Bridesmaids.
Right. Paul Feig directed both of those movies. And there have been some articles saying Bridesmaids hasn't had much of an effect on what kinds of roles are out there. I am among those who believe you have to wait a little longer and see whether it'll have an effect. I think sometimes you have to line up a couple. This is a terrific and funny movie that anybody could enjoy, as Bridesmaids was, any adult, I should say. And so I think the hope is you stack up a couple of successes and they stop being regarded as flukes.
Linda Holmes writes and edits NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. Linda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a quick heads up, later in the program, we're going to go to Gettysburg, where they're trying to balance tourism with the bloody history of the Civil War on this, the 150th anniversary of the three-day Gettysburg Battle. And up next, Fed Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke says, never mind, we'll clarify. That's in 30 seconds, here and now.
If you've been watching the stock market over the last week, there have been a lot of ups and downs, and it stems, at least in part, from a big Federal Reserve announcement last week. The Fed laid out more details about how it would start to wind down its monetary stimulus program. And yesterday, after the market reaction, a number of Fed officials came out to offer a little clarification. To help sort it all out, we're joined from Los Angeles now by Marilyn Cohen. She's a money manager with Envision Capital Management. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. Let's see if we can clear this up a little.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's first of all go back to last week, Ben Bernanke's press conference, and let's listen to what he said.
The committee currently anticipates that it would be appropriate to moderate the monthly pace of purchases later this year. We would continue to reduce the pace of purchases in measured steps through the first half of next year, ending purchases around mid-year.
So, Marilyn Cohen, what is the Fed chairman saying there in plain English?
In plain English, Mr. Bernanke is basically saying that they are going to slow down the pace of their monthly purchases of treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. That's it. That's his English sentence.
This is the major stimulus program that the Fed has been doing since the financial crisis. They are buying a lot of bonds to try to make it easier for people to lend and spend money in this economy. And he's saying we're going to start to slow that down.
Yes, because the formula worked. It worked in the sense that mortgage rates went down to generational lows. It probably helped corporate America to add on employees to their payrolls, and it certainly helped corporate America reduce their interest rate that they have to pay on the bonds that they issue. So it was basically a win-win situation. It may not have been a grand slam like some economists were looking for, but it did its job.
Okay, and then the markets did not love what the Fed chairman said, maybe understandably, because if money is going to get a little harder to come by for big banks, it might be harder for them to lend and spend. So then yesterday, Federal Reserve Governor Jerome Powell, among others, came out and tried to clear up some of the misunderstanding.
Market adjustments since May have been larger than would be justified by any reasonable reassessment of the path of policy. And in particular, the reaction of the forward and futures markets for short-term rates appears out of keeping with my assessment of the committee's intentions given its forecasts.
Which is to say what exactly, Marilyn Cohen?
They didn't like the market's reaction.
All right. So what are they trying to say that they said?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think that what investors have to zero in on is the fact that in the bond market, market sentiment has changed. Whether the liquidity is pulled away slowly but surely or it's more herky-jerky, the mindset has changed. Everybody you talk to, whether it's a man on the street or whether it's the man managing $15 billion in corporate bonds, we all said the same thing. Rates have no place to go but up. For the last 2 years, we've been saying that, and they've been pretty sanguine. Well, now that mantra has changed in the fact that rates are going up. not like 1994, but they have more than drifted up. So bond investors have spoken with their wallets, and they've stampeded out of all kinds of bond funds. And that sentiment has begat more selling, and large institutions have been selling. So don't just focus in on what the Fed is saying and how the cleanup team is trying to clean up what Bernanke said. Focus in on what the bond market is doing.
Okay, and that is where I want to go next, because that is the part of this that is actually going to affect people who are not on Wall Street, who are not making big investments. That affects everybody's mortgage or their car payment or their bank loans.
Exactly. And since May, 30-year mortgages have gone up more than 1%. So that has eliminated some people out of the market. Those people that were on the fence, should we buy, shouldn't we? Well, it doesn't have a good backyard. And now they're like, oh, I can't even afford it. Or it's become too onerous for us to take that leap.
Okay, so I guess the big question here is, because this program is going to come to an end eventually, how important at this point in our recovery is the Fed's stimulus?
Well, I would say it's still pretty darn important, because even the most adamant people that have not liked the quantitative easing, as the Fed has called it, they have to give the Bernanke a lot of credit, because the economy is significantly better than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. So I think that it is important, but we need to get rid of this artificiality that the Fed has created, because bond prices were artificially high, equity prices were artificially high, and I think that coming back to a real free and open market is the path they want to get on, and I want to be right on that path too.
Marilyn Cohen, money manager with Envision Capital Management, thanks so much for clearing that up.
My pleasure.
Temperatures in the Southwest dangerously high. For the second time in 100 years, Death Valley, California could break its own world record as the hottest place on Earth. Temperatures might reach the 1913 record of 134 degrees. Ann Thompson, who works at the Shoshone Post Office just south of Death Valley, says it's unbearable.
You know how they say you could fry an egg on the ground? Well, you can do that. Plus, it'll bake it a little bit further. Just imagine putting yourself in an oven. And you're going outside and you walked into an oven. That's how hot it is.
Wow. And we're learning also that when it gets that hot, it can be tough for airplanes to take off. Fred George is chief aircraft evaluation editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology, and says that most people think it's because the air is thinner, but that's not the real problem.
The principal problem for pilots when taking off in hot weather is what happens if you lose an engine on takeoff. This happens very, very, very infrequently, like once every several million flight hours. But all jetliners must be operated on the assumption that an engine will fail at the worst possible time during the takeoff, and there has to be sufficient power on the remaining engine or engines to complete a safe takeoff. And in hot weather, engines don't perform as well as they do in cold weather. So sometimes you have to offload cargo or passengers or fuel and take off at a lighter weight so the aircraft will have safe one engine inoperative takeoff performance.
Again, that's Fred George of Aviation Week and Space Technology. So in other words, Robin, your plane still might be able to take off, but you might not be on it.
Well, so we want to hear from our listeners. Where are you in the Southwest? How hot is it? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Because just as vacation season hits, you may be sitting in an airport with your plane taking off without you.
Yeah.
Back in a minute, Here and Now. A 150 years ago, Union and Confederate forces settled into camps just outside a small town in Pennsylvania. Myth has it they picked that town because it had shoe factories. Not true. It's also not true it was the largest battle of the Civil War, but it was certainly the costliest. The Union troops defeated the Confederate soldiers, but all paid dearly. Over 3 days of fighting, 51,000 were killed, wounded, or maimed at Gettysburg.
This is the sound of echo taps. It'll be heard several times over the next few days as thousands of tourists visit the Gettysburg National Military Park for the 150th anniversary. The challenge for the park, to balance tourism with respectful remembrance and truth. The grounds, so soaked in American blood, were consecrated a few months after the battle by President Lincoln as he delivered the Gettysburg Address. But he never spoke to two African-American Union soldiers who recite the Gettysburg Address back to him in the film Lincoln.
That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
John Heiser is one of the historians at Gettysburg National Military Park. He joins us for a look at the weeks ahead. Do people come and ask you, did Lincoln speak to those troops?
More and more, yes. History is taking kind of a back seat in our schools, unfortunately. In the 3 days of battle here, 46,000 young men, all Americans, were killed, wounded, maimed, or wound up as prisoners of war. In that entire month-long campaign, which began June 9th and ended on July 14th, 51,000 American lives were changed forever, killed, wounded, captured, missing. And I often say, if you want to see what numbers are and get an idea what those numbers are, next time you go to a large football game, large baseball game, look at the stands around you, because that's about equal to the number that were lost in 1863 during the Gettysburg campaign.
So how do you handle this delicate notion of hallowed ground and anniversary? For instance, there's Pickett's Charge, one of the most famous battles at Gettysburg. Do you do reenactments?
No, we don't. We sponsor living history programs on the battlefield. These are volunteers who come dressed as Union Confederate soldiers and are very much experts in the field of what soldier life was during the American Civil War. We don't sponsor opposing units, opposing fire on hallowed ground.
Yeah. But how do you get across the notion of what that battle might have been like? We understand you have people, and are going to have people in the next several weeks, a lot of events at Gettysburg, and one of them is these field walks where people will walk across the field where a battle was.
We think that gives people the best sense of what it was like, taking people over that part of the field where these regiments fought, where these men fought, and telling their story has more of an effect on people and their understanding of the event than would, say, a reenactment of fellows shooting each other with blanks over an open field.
What is that like? Because it's beautiful now. It can be tranquil. But we're hearing stories, for instance, you know, thousands were buried right in shallow graves. And then when there were heavy rains, bodies floated up and people thought they were seeing ghosts. In fact, there are ghost tours at Gettysburg at other times. We know Lincoln spoke. How does it feel to walk over that ground?
It's kind of an eerie feeling at times. For us to take people over the battlefield really is quite a privilege.
Well, Pickett's Charge is commemorated in a giant painting. This is the Battle of Gettysburg Cyclorama. People can go into this building and be in the middle of this cyclorama with a sound and light show. Let's just listen to a little bit of the sound. How do you see people respond when they're standing looking at this painting and hearing this sound?
They're overwhelmed. It put you right in the middle of a historic event. This particular one was first shown in Boston in 1884 before it was brought here in 1913. It put people right in the middle of what Pickett's Charge maybe looked like. All of the confusion, the cannon, the horses, the smoke. This was Gettysburg in 1863, almost like going to a movie.
No. And it's a pretty gory one.
Absolutely. Hundreds of men died in the most horrible possible ways.
There have been reunions of soldiers who fought in the Civil War. In 1938, at the 75th reunion, films were made of the former soldiers greeting each other. You can see them shaking hands across the wall. Let's listen.
2,500 veterans gather from north and south to mark the 75th anniversary of America's Armageddon.
Hello. You know, we're reminded that 75 years later, that meant that they were children when they fought, you know, in their teens. And you are going to have readings from letters and diaries of soldiers. I understand you have one with you. Read from the letter from Captain Francis Byrd of the North Carolina 11th Volunteer Infantry. He's writing to his cousin about a soldier and telling her that this soldier died on the first day of fighting.
It's one of the more descriptive letters that we have in our collection here, and letters like this will be read every night during the three-day anniversary. Captain Byrd was the captain of Company C of the 11th North Carolina, which had come from Birdie County, North Carolina. The letter he wrote on July 17, 1863, is to a cousin, and he says, "I received your letter directed to Joseph Casper, and knowing it to be from you, I opened it. You have heard before the death of poor Joe. He was killed on the first day of July in a fight near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Eddie Rhodes, who was lieutenant at the company, at the same time was also killed. We were ordered to charge several lines of battle of the enemy strong supported by batteries of artillery. My company suffered very severely, lieutenants, six privates killed, and many more wounded. I saw them all fall, but could stay with them but one moment as I was compelled to proceed in the charge, and before I could see that Joe was dead. The last I heard him say was, 'Corp, I am killed.' He fell nobly in the midst of his company, in the full discharge of his duty. He was shot in his leg, but the mortal wound was through his bowels, and he only lived but a short time." I think to receive a letter like that had to be devastating to the folks at home.
Do you ever see encounters between someone from the North and the South? What does it symbolize now?
It symbolizes not just a battleground, but it's a ground of reunion and reunification. You mentioned the reunion in 1938. In 1913 was the 50th anniversary of the battle. 54,000 Union Confederate veterans camped in this battlefield for 3 days. These former enemies walked over the battlefield like old friends, shaking hands, walking arm in arm, telling the old stories. And in several cases, soldiers who had helped others who were wounded on the other side, former enemies, had helped their former enemies. These men had encounters here in this field. They felt so strongly about it being a site of not just a battle to commemorate the two armies, but also as a site of reunification of the country. It wasn't just a matter of being in the blue or the gray. It was that they were all Americans. And what happened, happened. The war is finally over.
That's John Heiser, historian for Gettysburg National Military Park. John, thanks so much for sharing some thoughts with us.
You're welcome, Robin. Anytime.
The 150th anniversary of Gettysburg is formally July 1st through 3rd. To find out more, go to hereandnow.org. And we will have many more stories about the importance of this battle in the coming days when we also formally relaunch. That's going to happen on Monday.
You ready?
I'm ready. You ready?
I'm ready. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us to see what next week brings Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.